Well, I'm going to begin, I think, with the obvious, and that's, of course, the Iranian Armada. I don't know what the description of 300, I'm told, drones and missiles is. Either way, very large number. I'd also just add that my understanding is that the missiles are cruise missiles. So what we're talking about is an attack in slow motion. So in terms of your Israel, if you're the United States, and we can take them as sort of locked together when it comes to intelligence in terms of the Middle East. You would have seen these drones and missiles appear on your screens, and you would have had an awful long time to prepare to shoot them down. And my understanding is that very large numbers were shot down over Iraq and Jordan. And then at the very end, then we're dealing with Israel's own aircraft and also missile shield. So my understanding is that the RAF was involved, and the United States Air Force was also involved. And of course, one can guess that the RAF would have played a very minimum role here. The United States would have taken the lion's share. And I also understand that Jordan was involved, not just involved in terms of giving the go-ahead to overfly its airspace, but my understanding is that they were actually involved in some way. In terms of shooting down drones, I think it's also worth adding that these drones are very cheap, relatively speaking, and very unsophisticated. When I first saw them being exported to Russia and being used by Russia, I must admit that I slightly looked down my nose at them. What we have here are suicide drones. My understanding is that they cost roughly, for you and me, it's a fortune, for me especially, something like quarter of a million each. That sounds expensive, but if we look at the sort of average US drone, we're talking 6 million, $7 million dollars. We're talking dollars here, by the way. But you can carry on up into the 100 million each for the most sophisticated US drone. How relevant they are now, given the experience of Ukraine, I don't know, because what we have here are slow moving vehicles, easily detectable vehicles. And what Ukraine has shown is they're highly effective, used in large numbers as almost throwaway items. So far from actually, looking down at these drones that Russia bought, this seems, at least to me, to be the use of drones of the moment. You don't expect most of them to get through, most of them won't get through, but sufficient numbers, all things being equal, will get through to hit your enemy. Now, of course, what we're dealing with here isn't just Israel, as I've indicated. We're dealing with Israel plus its allies. And my guess, for what it's worth, is that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Iranian leadership would have calibrated this very carefully. And what they would be aiming for is something that had sufficient muscle to it, sufficient, how should I put it, shock and awe to it, and yet it wasn't going to be sufficient to actually land any serious blows on Israel. So my understanding is that one poor kid, a Bedouin child of 10 years old, was killed in this attack. Other than that, no one, that's my understanding from this morning, is that no one else in Israel was killed. And as I said, my guess is that Iran and its leadership would have gone for something like that. Now, it's true that the Houthis in Yemen apparently were involved. And I think I might be right in saying that included in the 300, there would be missiles launched from Lebanon by Hezbollah. But nonetheless, of course, the vast bulk of what we're talking about here is Iranian. And of course, from Iran's point of view, this is what they promised. When the ship Ares, I think it's called, was seized, my own response to that was, well, this isn't going to be enough, surely, to salvage Iran's honor, having seen its own home territory in diplomatic terms hit in Damascus with the loss of leading figures in the Revolutionary Guard. That they'd have to respond surely with more than the capture of an ultimately owned Israeli ship via Geneva, and I don't know how many other avenues. And lo and behold, here it is. As far as Iran is concerned, it says, well, that should close the matter. You've hit us, you've killed several of our leading Revolutionary Guard, you violated our diplomatic immunity. But we've hit you back. My own feeling is that while Iran's honor has been salvaged somewhat, and I've been told of reports in Iran itself of people, at least we think, are coming out onto the streets spontaneously. I'm sure the government is encouraging people. But I think there is a genuine, we've hit back feeling, and certainly throughout the Middle East, Hamas, Hezbollah, and various other, people involved in what they would regard as the resistance against Israel have warmly welcomed the biggest by far Iranian action since October the 7th. Well, having said that, my own hunch, I can't put it stronger than that, is that if I was Benjamin Netanyahu, while in public I would be huffing and puffing and being outraged at this attack on my home country, I would also at the same time be smiling inwardly like a Cheshire cat. Because to me, this is what the attack on Damascus and Iran's Revolutionary Guard leaders was all about. It was designed to provoke Iran in order to actually bring the United States directly into this conflict and to provide a series of escalations whereby it can continue to deal with the Palestinians in Gaza, attack Rafah, and perhaps up the ante on the West Bank. So my expectation would be, I could be utterly wrong, that the War Cabinet in Jerusalem will order another retaliation. Joe Biden is urging them not to, but that's my guess. And then Iran says, if you retaliate, we will retaliate. That's what they've already announced. So although Iran is saying, let's call it quits, I can't see Israel doing that. Now, I could be wrong because Biden could be really putting the pressure on. I don't know. But to me, if we look at, I would say, the consensus Zionist position in Israel would be that what we need is an international crisis, and then we can deal with our Palestinian problem. And what I mean by the Palestinian problem isn't Hamas. The Palestinian problem is precisely demographics. And if you take the project, which is there, that is either implicitly or explicitly embraced by all Zionist factions, bar very damn few, what they have an aim of is a greater Israel. And we've already seen, parts of the West Bank annexed. Recently, after October the 7th, we saw more of it annexed. There's legislation which could be enacted which allow the annexation of part of the West Bank down the side of the Jordan River. But ultimately, if you go for a greater Israel and you actually annex the whole of the West Bank and the whole of the Gaza Strip, you've got to get rid of the people, because having 20% of the population of Israel proper as Arabs, as hostile, that's one thing that's copable with. On the other hand, if you then add in the population of Gaza, the population of the West Bank, that becomes politically dangerous. We're starting to approach a situation of where Jews and Arabs, in terms of their numbers, are roughly equal. Israel has no vast pool of new colonists to call upon. This isn't a United States. This isn't an Australia. There are Jews, yes, in London, in New York, but very few of them are going to rush over to Israel in order to take up residence. Everyone knows that. We know that in terms of Israel, it's stretched its definition of what it is to be a Jew, i.e., what it's to be an insider when it comes to Israeli politics. So you get a situation where Russian Jews, plus their spouses, are defined as Jewish. And you only need a grandmother or something like that, or a grandfather, to make you Jewish, to make you an insider in the political system. But there isn't a big supply any longer of Eastern European or Russian Jews to call upon. So Israel has to get rid of people if it's going to function as a inverted commas, a bourgeois democracy, as a parliamentary system of one person, one vote, as Israel proper functions as. So a greater Israel requires the removal of large numbers, and we're talking about very large numbers of Palestinians. So Moshe Makover has long argued that Israel, and not just Likud and Netanyahu, were waiting for their opportunity to carry out another act of ethnic cleansing. And of course, what surprised us all was that instead of the main target being the West Bank, where everyone had their eyes on, including the Israeli establishment, and we're not just talking about Likud, we can go back to 67 and the conquest of that territory by a Labour Zionist government. No, instead it turns around to be the Gaza Strip, and that was just an accident. I wasn't expecting Hamas attack. Israel wasn't expecting a Hamas attack. Anyone who had good intelligence, on the other hand, and took notice of their intelligence, knew it was coming, or knew, at least knew that something was planned over the last year. But those leading Israel, including on the military side, not just the political side, chose to ignore that information. Either way, Hamas attacked on October the 7th. They were expecting almost instantly 90% casualty rate. Their targets were military targets, police targets. Instead, their militants find themselves going beyond that. And we all know the rest of the story. Either way, yes, Israel has come under pressure from all manner of different sides. But the crucial question, it's come under pressure from the United States, not because Joe Biden cares, sorry, a damn about Palestinian lives, but what he cares about is the general stability of the Middle East. You know, how stable is the Saudi government of MBS? How stable is the Jordanian regime of King Abdullah? How stable is the regime in Cairo of Sisi? Well, you ask the question, and I can give you a one-line answer. They're all unstable, and precisely under the conditions that we're in. You know, I'm expecting something. I don't know when, I don't know what, but at some point something will happen, and I'll turn around, you know, like some prophet, and sort of say, "I told you so." Well, quite frankly, anyone could tell you that something will happen. Now, whether that be from junior officers, more senior officers, whether that will be the Muslim Brotherhood, I haven't got a clue, but something at some time will give. And that's precisely what Biden and the CIA, the military establishment in the United States, are afraid of, plus the pressure that they're under domestically from people who are threatening not to vote Democrat, not to vote Biden, not to vote Trump, sure, but to either vote for a third candidate or put two fingers up and just simply abstain in an election that at the moment looks like it will be a close run thing. And indeed, I don't know what the latest opinion polls are, but the ones that I have read actually show Trump ahead in the popular vote. Now, that matters in the United States in the same way that it matters in terms of Britain and Westminster elections, because we have first past the post. And in US states, what you have is indirect election. And the fact is that the whole system at the moment, for historic reasons, is biased in favor of the Republicans. So that needs to be understood. So the fact that Trump is ahead in terms of public opinion polls means that he'll be even further ahead when it comes to the election of electors who elect the president. So, in other words, if Biden is being threatened with abstentions because of people, you know, wanting to express their solidarity, their disgust with the crocodile tears that Biden is shedding over Palestinian lives, meanwhile supplying Israel with the means of destruction, well, that is also a form of political pressure, a worry for Biden. So my argument is that Biden is under pressure from two sides. That's the stability of his allies in the Middle East, bar Israel, And of course, the survival of the Biden regime itself come the November elections. So, my feeling is that Israel knew this, planned this. That's why it attacked Damascus. It expected some sort of Iranian response, to which I think, at least in terms of what they want to do, they want to retaliate and they want a tit for tat that takes things further and further to the point where Israel is basically given the go-ahead, and that means being supplied with the means, either for a joint military operation against Iran alongside the United States, or a military operation in its own name that has to be bankrolled by the United States. And what I'm thinking of is something along the lines of, and this will all be pre-planned, all the war plans will be there, something like an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. And of course, we know that Iran, in terms of uranium enrichment, has not got there in terms of nuclear grade, but it's gone way beyond what you would use in civilian nuclear power stations. So this is a pre-warhead stage of purification. Not there. They haven't gone that far, but they could go that far pretty quickly. They've got the missiles. They could deliver a warhead. And if they've got sufficient missiles, maybe one gets through. That will be the calculation in Tehran, that to have a nuclear deterrent, it's got to be an effective nuclear deterrent. And of course, what we're talking about is there's only one nuclear power in the Middle East, that's Israel. It's got about 100 effective nuclear warheads, and it has the ability to deliver them. And Israel wants to maintain that monopoly of terror. And to achieve that, it's long had the ambition of knocking out Iran's nuclear weapons program. I'll call it weapons program. Now, we're not talking about an Israeli invasion of Iran. That's impossible. That simply can't happen. And we're not talking about a US invasion of Israel, but we might be talking either about a so-called surgical strike. Now, that would require, as I said, I think US, not just the go-ahead. I don't know enough about Israel's arsenal, but my understanding last time I looked, it would require direct supply by the United States, not just of the sort of bunker bomb, buster busting bombs, excuse me, that Israel has been supplied with in terms of attacking Hamas tunnels in Gaza, but sort of super bunker busters of the sort that the United States, I think, for demonstration purposes, attacked a series of caves in Afghanistan when it was fighting the Taliban. I mean, it launched this, I don't know what it was called, but something like the mother of all bunker buster bombs. It was something along those lines. Huge, huge weight that, to my knowledge, no Israeli fighter aircraft could possibly hope to lift. My memory of the US attack on these caves was its bomb was actually launched, a guided bomb was actually launched out of the back of a transport aircraft. So something like a Hercules, cargo plane. There, the hatch goes down at the back, the bomb is launched, and it then is guided. I presume from pilots back in the United States to its target. Israel would need something like that. Now, it's quite conceivable that without the US helping it, Israel might attack nuclear facilities, but it can't actually get through these concrete domes that Iran has put over its nuclear facilities. And not least the fact that some of these facilities are not only covered in concrete, but are deep underground. So you need something that's got sufficient power to break through this concrete, sufficient power then to direct the explosion downwards and not just upwards. Either way, that's all me speculating. But I wouldn't be surprised by something like that. But that's not really the aim. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize, that to me, the world will be looking at this. We'll be talking about the potential of Israel perhaps even using nuclear weapons, because that's an alternative. If you haven't got the conventional explosive power, they've got the nuclear explosive power ready and available. So the world will be looking at this, the world is on the edge of this catastrophe of war between Israel and Iran. Meanwhile, Israel carries out its starvation, its ethnic cleansing, maybe its expulsion of the Gazan masses, and ups the ante in the West Bank and waits for any opportunity for the inevitable Palestinian demonstration, for the inevitable Palestinian bomb or bullet, in order to start moving to expel even more people from their land, but also from the West Bank itself, presumably over the Jordan River into the Kingdom of Jordan. Meanwhile, I don't know what the United States will be doing. Will they be shedding crocodile tears? Will they be urging restraint? Perhaps. Will they be cutting off arms? I doubt it. But again, that isn't something that's set in stone. That's a political calculation that the Biden administration will be making. Of course, the pressure needs to be kept up. In Britain, the arms exports to Israel are pretty irrelevant. Yes, no doubt some bits and pieces of F-35s, the most sophisticated fighter bomber on the planet, are made in Britain. But from our angle, what matters is the politics of this. And it's correct to campaign for a ban on all arms exports to Israel, a government ban. Yes, we need workers involved. But yeah, we are in favor of a government ban. And also, this is something inevitably that affects our domestic politics, not just in terms of the government, but also for the government in waiting. Because what we have with Sir Keir Starmer and his Labour Party is a US lapdog. And whatever the Biden administration says one day, the British Labour Party says the next. Not one step in front, always one step behind. So if Biden is shedding crocodile tears, you'll find the day after Keir Starmer is doing the same thing. Remember, Keir Starmer is the one that said Israel was right to withhold water from these people, medical supplies, food from these people. That was Sir Keir Starmer. That wasn't just Rishi Sunak. Okay. So that's the point on that one. Okay. Quick comment on Ukraine. I've been looking at my news outlets, and I came across a story, not just one, but a whole number of stories that are ringing the warning bell. Looking at Ukraine, we all know the story. It's real. And that is the Biden administration cannot get through their 60 billion arms package for Ukraine through the US Congress. Well, seem to have managed it through the Senate, but it's the House of Representatives that is the blockage at the moment. And what we have, of course, is a campaign conducted throughout NATO and beyond for the Republicans in the House of Representatives to go along and negotiate in a bipartisan fashion with Biden to get this desperately needed package through. Now, I haven't got a clue. I don't know enough about American politics to come down and will this go through? What I've read Speaker Johnson. Is it Speaker Johnson? Yeah, head of the Republican faction in the House of Representatives, saying, well, it would go through if we can negotiate not just a free package for Ukraine, but a loan, such as the United States advanced to Britain in World War II, in Britain's hour of need. If we can do that, this is a doable deal, he says. Now, I don't know, because there's also talk amongst Republicans in the United States of replacing Johnson because apparently he's too soft. I don't know. I don't know enough about US politics, but of course we had David Cameron over in Washington, not only talking to Biden but also to Donald Trump, who of course is the leader of the Republican Party in the United States, and clearly it's Trump that's wanting to weaken the Biden administration. Whether that means in reality that Trump, if he did win in November, then in January can deliver within 24 hours a peace deal in Ukraine, I'm somewhat skeptical of. But leave that one aside. In my mind, there can be no doubt that this aid package, this war package, matters. I don't see Europe or Japan or any other such country overcoming the shortage caused by this delay in Washington. And I know there are some skeptics that say, artillery, what does that matter? Nowadays, in the era of drone warfare, electronic warfare, satellite warfare, and all the rest of it, let me just say this: that even this Iranian drone that I talked about, in a snooty wrong way, that cost $250,000, as I said. Now contrast that with an artillery shell. My understanding is, well, where an Iranian drone costs $250,000, a US artillery piece costs $5,000. In other words, if we look at what's been going on in Ukraine, and we would look at what we would expect modern warfare, and it all depends on what particular the two sides are and all the rest of it. But my point really is that artillery is not out of date. I would make the argument that aircraft carriers are, and maybe now I would make the argument, looking at Ukraine, that the ultra sophisticated drones that the United States has been building, perhaps they are now antiquated in the era of mass drone warfare. Not one drone as they had, hovering for days up in the skies of Afghanistan. Ukraine and Russia get through thousands of drones every week. And I think, for example, when I first read the figure, I almost double took. I read a figure that the Ukrainian side was losing 40,000 drones a month. When I read it, I just went, what? Because some of these drones aren't the size of the Iranian ones. They're not carrying anything, nowhere near as deadly. Sometimes they're just there for observation purposes, and sometimes they're capable of carrying nothing more than a hand grenade. Either way, the point would be that drones are easy to shoot down, and if they're cheap, so what sort of type idea. But the point is that what we have in the form of artillery warfare now is artillery warfare informed by drone warfare. So what you have is artillery officers who are given precise directions of this is where the enemy is, this is what you strike at. Okay, they cannot do it with absolute precision. So these aren't guided artillery shells, of course not, but they are mass. And what you need, just like in World War I, is in order to take territory, what you need is artillery, and what you need to keep territory are infantry. That's been the pattern that was quickly established in Ukraine after the initial phase, where we saw the use of tanks. We quickly settled down to what looks like, at least to me, to being some sort of rerun of World War I on the Western Front. And of course, it was Russia which went in for trench warfare. And again, I've endlessly described the, you know, the three layers of defense, the concrete, you know, the dragon's teeth, and the fact that Ukraine, as I speak, is doing the same on its side of not only the front line, but all the way up the international frontier between the two countries. And what I would expect, in spite of various headlines in the British press in terms of a spring offensive, because apparently things are drying out, it's sunshine at the moment, and therefore Russian tanks have been doing X, Y, and Z. Well, my prediction is in Ukraine that you might have had some dry weather. But what we've got in Ukraine, in terms of my understanding, is it's called spring. And what that means is you might have some warm days, you might have some non-wet days, but you're going to have a lot more wet days. And the general expectation, I think, isn't of a Russian spring offensive, it's a summer offensive. And what we have is a race, I think, between the ground drying out to enable offensive warfare and Ukraine digging its trenches, putting in place its three lines of defenses. And of course, you know, without mass artillery, then it means that Russia can attack with tanks, maybe make a breakthrough. I have to say, though, that some of the headlines that I've read, I don't know whether that's called clickbait or not, either way, I've read them. This is about Ukraine is just about to collapse if it doesn't get its US aid. I'm very, very skeptical. You know, what we have, in spite of the problem of conscription, in spite of the shortage of ammunition, in spite of, you know, people no longer being enthusiasts for the war that they were in the initial phase in, well, 2 years ago, what we're dealing with, I think, isn't going to be a pushover. You know, people will resist the Russian invader. That was my feeling, and it remains my feeling, even if they are reduced to partisan warfare, which I don't envisage. I don't envisage Russia conquering the whole of Ukraine in 2024. It's possible that the Ukrainian army simply collapses, but as I said, I'm extremely skeptical on it. So I turn to my Daily Telegraph article headline. Ukraine could face defeat in 2024. Skeptical reader opens the article by General Sir Richard Barron. He's an ex something about clearly a leading military ex leading military official, but still talking on behalf of the military establishment in the UK. And not to my surprise, quite the opposite, it just confirmed my expectation. What he was saying is that, well, we all knew what direction the Ukrainian summer offensive, and it always was going to be a summer offensive, in spite of the fact that it was flagged as a spring offensive. It did come, yeah, 1 week before spring finally ended. I can remember correcting my article. Bastards started the offensive as I was just about to publish. Either way, we knew when it would happen, and we knew the direction it would take. It would go south, and the aim was of the war planners, from the Pentagon, from Britain and Ukraine, is that they would break through with their new shiny Leopard 2 tanks and a few American tanks and a few British tanks added on. They would break through Russian lines of defense, and then they would make their way all the way down to the Azov Sea. I have to say, a skeptic when it came to that, and it didn't surprise me when Ukraine, yeah, managed to penetrate the first line of Russian defenses and get no further. In other words, the Ukrainian offensive was a complete failure, and their first contact with the enemy, they lost tanks, they lost armored cars, and they were reduced to using infantry at night, crawling on their bellies in order to demine Russian defenses. But even then, it got nowhere. What will happen with a Russian offensive? Well, as I said, it depends on putting in place these defenses. They haven't put them in place yet. Zelensky has given them a target of the end of spring. And then we wait and see. And what my General Sir Richard Barron's tells us is exactly what you'd expect. Well, maybe the Russians will try to capture more territory in the Donbass. I go myself, why is me? Well, that's possible. Maybe, he says, they will go south and get more. No, south, it'll be north for them. Sorry, got me geography wrong. Maybe they will go north and try to capture more Zaporizhzhia. Maybe they will go to the east. And I've got to get my. Is it? Yeah, it's the east, isn't it? Maybe they'll go to the east and plough along the Black Sea. In other words, Sir Richard doesn't know. I don't know. But who the hell knows? But it does matter in terms of artillery shells. That's really what I'm saying. Doesn't mean that you're on the verge of collapse, on the other hand. But Russia, yeah, could make substantial advances. It could capture more territory. It could capture a city or two. Does that mean that Kiev is about to fall in 2024? I somehow doubt it. And indeed, I have to say myself, I wrote it in my recent article. I want someone to explain this to me. I mean, I've tried to find out why the hell, when your country has just been invaded and you're talking about this evil Putin, who not only wants to incorporate Ukraine into a greater Russia. I mean, this is what we were told. Why the hell didn't they mobilize people from 18 upwards? They barred officially people from 18 to 60 leaving the country. Of course, that doesn't mean people haven't left the country, but why didn't they mobilize young people? So when I've been told on these forums, and I had no re reason to argue, I had simply had to look it up, the average age of a frontline Ukrainian soldier is 43. That means you've got some old farts. I'm not being ageist here, but you've got some old farts as well as the 43-year-olds. You'll have 50-year-olds, 55-year-olds. When it comes to the front line, how much puff have these guys got? You can be wise when you're 55, so they tell me. But when it comes, to energy, young people leave us old guys far, far behind. Now, of course, you'd still have your exemptions, students from people, going to university to study courses that matter to your war effort and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, the fact that until just now, again, when it came to me writing the damned article, I was sort of posing this question to my readers and myself, why is the age of mobilization 27 when Zelensky has had legislation through the Rada, through the Ukrainian parliament for a year, allowing it to 25? Why 25? And he wasn't acting upon it. Well, I speculated maybe there's an anti-war mood amongst that generation. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, someone needs to tell me. It's not because, and I think this needs emphasizing, it's not because if you take the Ukrainian population as a whole, that what we're dealing with here is any noticeable numbers, any significant numbers of pro-Russian Ukrainian people in what is now really Ukraine, Ukrainian-held Ukraine. That if we look at the east and we look at the south, the 18% of the population that is ethnically Russian, most of them will be there. Most of those that have any sympathy for Ukraine would have got out. And we know that something like 600,000 people, men between the ages of 18 and 60, have left. They haven't tended to flock to Russia to sign up to their army. No, they've gone to Europe. And I presume that can be for a whole number of different reasons. But clearly, these people are not burning with patriotic fervor. So that could include people who have a certain sympathy or a wish not to kill fellow Russian speakers. Whatever the explanation is, the fact that the draft has been limited to 27 and has now just been reduced to 25 is something of a mystery to me. Either way, the point I'm really trying to get over is that when you read General Sir Richard, he isn't talking about the collapse of Iraq, of Ukraine. He's not talking about Russian troops marching into Kiev. He's talking, in essence, of something, yes, beyond tactical gains, which Russia has been making over the winter and spring. I, you know, yeah, a town, but no breakthrough. Maybe in the summer, maybe, Russia makes more substantial gains than that. Okay, well, Stan, I'm gonna finish in terms of my last few minutes, just very briefly, by turning to an article in this week's Socialist Worker, signed by, I think he's still the editor, Charlie Kimber. And it's an article on what's going on amongst the left that's no longer in the Labour Party. And what we've had over, I think, this weekend is a meeting up in Blackburn and a meeting in London yesterday. And the first meeting in Blackburn is in part to do with people who've resigned as Labour councillors in Lancashire. That's why I presume the Blackburn location. And the list of speakers are worthwhile, at least the ones I've heard of are just worthwhile mentioning. George Galloway, Salma Yacoob from Birmingham. Former joint, no, she was vice leader, wasn't she, or something like that, of Respect. Craig Murray, former British ambassador up in Scotland, wasn't British ambassador up in Scotland, but he lives in Scotland, has been involved in SNP type politics. Michael Lavalette, some comrades here might recognize the name, who was a respect councillor, member of the SWP. He is speaking up there. But our Charlie has discovered that amongst those who have signed up to become Worker Party candidates for the forthcoming general election, there's one Billy Howarth and there's a John P. Collins. And it turns out upon investigation of these two people, apparently anyone can apply and you have to fill in a long list of questions to George Galloway, and you have to pledge that you agree with their manifesto that was actually written not only by George Galloway, but I would suggest Jyoti Bra and her brother. I think it's her brother, isn't it? Either way, it's written by the son and daughter of Harpal Bra, the famous Stalinist, who is the ex-chair of the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist. So they've got stuff about Cuba and the achievements of the Soviet Union and all the rest of it. Either way, what we have with two of their candidates is some very dodgy media postings, and I presume that they've been withdrawn as candidates. But our Charlie says, well, that just goes to show you, doesn't it? And he ends his this bit of the article by saying, the ballot box, this is all irrelevant. What matters, what really matters, is street demonstrations. The ballot box is going to get you nowhere. Well, this is more anarchism, Charlie, than it is Marxism. That if you actually look in the Second International, what distinguished the Marxists and their allies and the anarchists and their allies is the anarchists were against what was called political action. And what they meant by that was they wanted to keep things to the strikes. What they wanted is keep things to demonstrations and seizing power. So you have an insurrectionary, a general strike. And what the Marxists said was, well, we don't dispute, you know, that these methods of struggle can play a role. They might be necessary. In the meantime, what we've got to do is build mass parties. We've got to build a state within a state. And Engels famously commented that the model was provided by German social democracy that, you know, ended up as the biggest party in the German Reichstag. Now, we all know what happened in 1914. We can go into the ins and that, but I'm not going to. Suffice to say that if we look at the Third International, while it thought that the world was on the edge for understandable reasons of repetitions of the October Revolution, that didn't mean it dismissed the importance of using elections. It's stressed, actually, if you look at the debates of Comintern, that elections were highly important and could be highly effective. And indeed, if you look at Lenin's famous advice to the CPGB when it was being founded, remember, he intervened on the side of the British Socialist Party and those comrades that were advocating parliamentary action against the comrades that were engaged in unity negotiations that rejected parliamentary action and affiliation to the Labour Party as a matter of principle. And as it turned out, if you look at the debates and the final vote, it was a pretty close run thing that the CPGB adopted the affiliation tactic, but also the election tactic. It wasn't overwhelming. Certainly the comrades on, I'll call them leftist comrades, while they all express admiration for the Bolsheviks and admiration for Lenin, they stuck doggedly to anti-parliamentarianism. And that wasn't just Sylvia Pankhurst and her comrades. Either way, what we have is Charlie dismissing the Workers' Party and its attempt to reach out and form some sort of bloc to challenge not only Rishi Sunak, but Keir Starmer in the forthcoming general election. Because it's using the ballot box, we also have them dismissing George Galloway on the basis of stressing class politics. And don't you recognize the importance of championing the oppressed? Because this is what our friends Billy and John didn't do as far as Charlie was concerned. Well, my answer to Charlie on that particular question, Charlie, don't you remember being in Respect alongside George Galloway? Don't you remember being part of the SWP bloc that voted down the proposal to have the right of free movement, an opposition to migration controls? Don't you remember voting down a woman's right to choose to have an abortion? Don't you remember that? Don't you remember SWP speakers being fielded in that Respect conference in order to rally the SWP to vote down the idea of republicanism? Apparently, I think they're right. Apparently, if you vote down republicanism, do you know what? This is the SWP speaker. You're going to put off royalist voters. That's what we were told. What we have with the SWP is that we actually put forward one of their what we stand for principles, what they publish every week in Socialist Worker about international socialism. They voted that down. So the idea that it's suddenly become a key question is welcome news. But how about some criticism, some real criticism of the SWP's time in Respect? It's uncritical time, unreflective time in Respect. It's all very well now preaching about George Galloway and his attitude towards trans people or his attitude on abortion. I agree, it's open to criticism. All very well preaching about George Galloway's limits when it comes to the migration question. I agree with the criticisms that the Conways make, but how about owning up that they took a completely unprincipled, completely opportunist position when they were in alliance with George Galloway? How about some honest self-criticism? That would help. And then it would mean that we will be able to treat these comrades seriously, because I think what's going on here is posturing. And I think what the SWP is doing is trying to cohere its own ranks and trying, therefore, to seal them off and say the only thing that matters is strikes and demonstrations. So you ignore history, you even ignore their own history, let alone the history of the Marxist movement going right back to the earliest days. After all, one of the sources of Marxism is the Chartist movement. Engels comes over to Britain, goes to work in Manchester. Okay, work. Yeah, he was the son of one of the owners. We all know that. But he's struck by the Chartist movement, the working class Chartist movement. And he sees this as the future. What was the aim of the Chartist movement? It was to win universal male suffrage. I'm emphasizing male. Not for any particular reason, but just to say universal, well, yeah, but nonetheless, Engels argued that if that had happened, if that had been won by the working class movement, by physical force, Chartism, it would have amounted to a social revolution. The House of Lords would have been swept aside, the monarchy would have been swept aside. And of course, what the physical force Chartists had was the charter. Plus, they had a social program. Either way, of course, what the Chartists were after is to use the ballot box. And to me, that whole question of the ballot box is fundamental to Marxist strategy. It's not fetishizing it in the way that reformists do, saying the ballot box and that's it, and we'll add a little bit here and a little bit there. But certainly the ballot box is one of the major fields of struggle as far as Marxists are concerned. And indeed, if we actually take, the class struggle, I would say that we would put economic strikes, where you struggle for yourself, for your family, for your kids, we'd put that as the most basic, most primitive form of the class struggle, because that can take a collective form, it can also take an individual form. The highest form of the class struggle, at least under conditions of capitalism, is preparation to make an insurrection. But fighting elections can be somewhere in the middle. And indeed, as we saw in the year 1917, it can also be something that can provide an antechamber to actually making an insurrection. Either way, there's another a bit of Charlie's article that's worthwhile mentioning. Over this same weekend, we had the meeting in London, and this was Jeremy Corbyn's Peace and Justice. And again, I'm only picking the speakers because it tells you something about what's going on here. Speakers include various sessions, no votes, as far as I understand. Jeremy Corbyn, well, that's no surprise. Andrew Fisher, as far as I know, Andrew is still a member of the Labour Party. He was, at least when I heard him interviewed, I think it was Friday or Thursday on Radio 4. We also have John Rees as a speaker. That tells you something about the Peace and Justice project. And we also have Fran Heathcote, who I think is the new General Secretary of the PCS, the Civil Servants Union, to use shorthand. Their political demands are utterly anodyne, a pay rise for the many, wow, housing for all, absolutely worthy, Green New Deal with public ownership, tax the rich to save the NHS, and welfare reform, and a world for peace, not war. You might as well bung in, apple pie and motherhood, and I'm sure they will if you move the amendment. I don't expect myself that they'll get more detailed than that. But there seems, at least at the moment, therefore, to be two rival platforms. Maybe they will merge, but clearly at the moment, the SWP is taking a hands-off approach. My fear, my expectation is, though, I could be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, is that what we will have in either case, whether they merge or whether they stay separate, is in essence a Bonapartist operation of the sort that we saw with Jeremy Corbyn and Momentum, and the sort of operation that we have with George Galloway and the Workers' Party. George Galloway, I don't know what the structure of the Workers' Party is. Whatever it is, George Galloway gets his way. And whether it's in a merged organisation, it's Jeremy Corbyn who gets his way, or whether it's George Galloway who gets his way, I don't know. But at the end, what we're dealing with, I don't think, is a commitment to transparent and democratic functioning. So that is something that if these organizations open themselves up, we should consider. So I finish on that.